Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host, Ryan Krause, dragging you down to the dark depths of the ocean to release the Kraken once again, this time in the form of the incomparable Colin Ferguson. No, not the Canadian actor who's been murdering my efforts to Google this case properly, but in fact, the infamous perpetrator of the 1993 Long Island Railroad Massacre, which claimed the lives of 6 innocent people and left 19 more severely wounded. You see, on December 7th, 1993, 35-year-old Colin Ferguson purchased a ticket to board the No. 3 train at Penn Station in New York City, where he then remained in the third car as the trip commenced and proceeded outside the city limits. As it approached the Marillon station, Colin, a Jamaican immigrant, stood up and removed a Ruger 9mm pistol from his jacket, simultaneously revealing 160 rounds of ammunition in a canvas bag he held. With approximately 80 other passengers at his mercy in the train car, the agitated man opened fire in a racially motivated attack, primarily targeting white people, with Asians being desirable as well. What followed was 3 minutes of terror, as Ferguson played God with the lives around him, firing round after round to satisfy his thirst for blood. So, we're not going to be looking at a whodunit in this case. It's Colin Ferguson. What concerns me is the why. Colin follows a pattern of behavior from start to finish. His actions are the result of inevitability, not unpredictability. Mental illness is no different than normal brain function in the sense that it, too, relies upon the recognition of patterns to create logic. The difference is that the logic of a madman is unique to himself and inaccessible to all outsiders. But the pattern from which it's derived is not. So I want to identify the pattern that unfolded in Colin Ferguson's life, that turned him into the man-child, and ultimately caused a descent into psychosis, from which he would never return. And we're going to utilize one of my favorite techniques in arriving at that conclusion. Mirrors. Colin's pain will mirror the thing he hates. Plain and simple. This type of psychology plays out over and over with almost all mass murderers. The thing they hate is their weak link. So, we're going to identify Colin's emotional wound to unearth the reasons why somebody would fly off the handle and kill, and then put it within the context of the horrific crime that ultimately transpires. My particular interest is the public reaction that tends to dictate such cases are specific to racism when, in my opinion, racism merely acts as a conduit through which the faulty pattern of logic is filtered to become mental illness. Colin will follow a very specific pattern of logic that renders him in a state of psychosis. And one of the most common attributes of psychosis is, for lack of a better term, duality, a propensity for creating an invisible human counterpart split from your own personality. Basically, it's someone with whom you can agree, disagree, and everything in between by way of conversations with yourself, created for the sole intent of satisfying the reality that no one else is capable of understanding your logic anymore. It prevents the reality of the person's harrowing isolation from becoming apparent, and is the reason, as I've mentioned before, that so many mentally ill homeless people stare into windows, mirrors, and other reflective things when they talk to themselves. In essence, you become a cult leader of one, and as the subject you've created is born of your faulty logic, it only stands to reason it will comply with such. Essentially, the phantom created by splitting your personality into two parts is intended to, and always does, reinforce the strength of the logic being utilized, at least in the mind of the person speaking. And that's what makes psychosis so scary. Many people experiencing it are not doing so in the context of violence, and they're harmless. But for those who have, in fact, arrived at the point of psychosis specifically based upon the irrational rhetoric of potential acts of hate and violence, it isn't a question of if, but when. That bomb is going to explode. You can hear the ticking and see the fuse lit long before it actually happens. But you can't do anything to stop it from happening. You just have to wait for the explosion and act accordingly. That's Colin Ferguson, a societal menace who spewed racial hate in every direction. Because it isn't illegal to be angry. It isn't illegal to be depressed, or to suffer the perceptions of institutionalized racism. And it certainly isn't illegal to raise your voice. But the price we pay in exchange for those freedoms is sometimes high. In a country where success stares you in the face at every turn, sometimes it's hard to look away. Sometimes it's hard to not feel degraded or worthless, alone. Most of us are that person, regardless of race or socioeconomic status. Most of us are envious, discouraged, and often disturbed by some type of inequality, whether it's related to race, gender, social status, or any other related factor. That's an intentional move by evolution to keep us wanting and making comparisons that will fuel action to be perceived as better than the next person. And so, the case we're about to review comes down to one evolutionary idea. You're either doing something to change the world, or you're complaining instead. History shows evolution rewards change and is indifferent to complaints. The purgatory for this process is a perpetual state of anger where nothing changes but the intensity of the bad feelings. It's like boiling water. You started with something harmless, added fire and time, and a deadly weapon emerged. This principle extends to everything in our world. The only way to cool an engine is movement, plain and simple. The same thing that creates the heat also cools it. We make engines like that because it's a microcosm of our existence and of evolution as a whole. If we don't keep moving, we're going to overheat and die. The lifespan of the sun dictates this notion is true, above and beyond everything else in the universe. If we don't keep moving, we're going to get swallowed by our sun in time. It's a fact. So everything we make that creates physical change, in the form of propulsion, is done so by way of generating heat through movement and then cooling with the same process. It works the same way when you go outside and ride your bike. You create body heat by pedaling, thereby propelling the bike forward, creating movement, change, and cooling. The reward is you go somewhere you had a greater desire to be at that time than you did for the place from which you departed. That's our world. Evolution is a cooling system. It's controlled no differently than the thermostat on your wall. If it gets too hot in your home, it signals the need for movement. Your AC unit kicks on, blows cool to satisfy that requirement, and the reward is cold air. You feel better, your body works more efficiently in the cooler temperature, and you think more clearly. The same goes for movement within the framework of humanity. If you engage constant change, it's your best chance to not burn up and seize due to the pressures of life. The same thing goes for space travel. If you want to leave or return to Earth, you have to do so at a very high rate of speed, aka change, or you'll literally disintegrate in flames. If the radiator fan stops working in your car, and you're driving 65 miles per hour, you'd never even know. It wouldn't have any effect on cooling the vehicle. That is, until you stop. Once you stop, or slow to a crawl, the vehicle is going to overheat very quickly. And, subjected to these conditions for too long, the engine is literally going to die. If an engine seizes due to a heat-related problem, it has to be rebuilt. It's dead. So in the same way we cool our bodies by way of blood flow, an engine does just that with oil or its synthetic equivalent. The physical parallels here are obvious. But what's really fascinating, and delves into a mysterious gray area, is emotion. If blood lubricates the human body, and oil lubricates an engine, what regulates emotion within that same context? The answer, of course, is constant change. Emotional stagnancy is no different than driving a car without oil, or even sitting in it on a summer afternoon with the windows up until you overheat and die. What humanity can never seem to understand, but will come to realize with advances in technology, is that we aren't haunted by the past. We just have no business being there. Ever. Even reminiscing about it over a few drinks is depressing, no matter how many laughs are garnered from the recollection. Because it's gone. And evolution will remind you, if you have a bad day and dwell on it, be prepared for increasing mental anguish until you stop. Because there's a reason our eyes are on the front of our heads. We're intended to move forward. At all times. That's what alphas do. Anything that runs in this world is blind to what chases it and winds up being swallowed by nature. Conquest occurs by facing your fears. If you look at non-predatory animals in the wild, experts have a tendency to describe them in the context of having evolved in a manner that allows the resulting features to make them better equipped for the purpose of escaping predators. Yet this is ridiculous. Evolution does not cater to the weak. It serves the predator, not the prey. The prey evolve only in service of making the predator stronger. They don't matter in and of themselves, only in the grand scheme. Faster, more intelligent, more agile prey still lose in the end. They always will, no matter how sophisticated they become. Because the game is rigged. Their improvements are specifically designed to help the predators become stronger through adaptation to the new attributes and skill sets of prey they seek. And guess what? That's exactly what goes on every day in humanity as well. It's the basis for the case we're about to discuss. Colin Ferguson refused to adapt emotionally to the circumstances presented to him by his changing environment by resisting maturity, and subsequently had a complete and total meltdown. So, let's go back to the beginning of this tale to learn what kind of a boy grows up to be a man who opens fire with a handgun inside a packed rush-hour train car. What went wrong that caused Colin Ferguson to veer off the straight and narrow? It all starts back in 1958, when Colin is born to Von Herman and May Ferguson and raised in Havendale, Jamaica, a suburb of Kingston. With Von being the head of a pharmaceutical company, he was often noted as perhaps the most prominent businessman in Jamaica at the time. The family enjoyed a two-story house complete with a nanny and housekeepers. Needless to say, they did pretty well. But I think we need to place this success within context to fully understand what transpires in Colin's future. Many people in Jamaica are raised under very poor conditions in comparison to first world countries, even to the extent that some live in shacks with no running water or electricity. In fact, that's fairly common in the lesser populated areas of the country. Furthermore, Kingston has a reputation for being a dangerous place ridden with crime and related violence. It's definitely not the first choice of visiting foreign tourists looking to get away from it all. So with Colin coming from a healthy suburban existence where he seemingly wanted for nothing in the way of necessities and was in fact afforded luxuries such as good parents, a large home, a nanny, and housekeepers, it would be fair to say that in the context of the DNA lottery to which we're all vulnerable, for better or worse, Colin Ferguson did pretty well. The solid structure around him afforded the young Colin the ability to earn good grades and graduate from a private high school in the top third of his class, where he excelled in soccer and cricket. For all intents and purposes, Colin Ferguson was a privileged youth. But then his parents died. That's right. Both of them. By age 20, Colin is left to fend for himself, and his future is uncertain, to say the least. It becomes apparent to the young man that Jamaica is likely not going to afford him the opportunities he seeks, so he makes the decision to emigrate to America. Right away, we can identify some potential issues he'll encounter in the process. Long story short, Jamaica's history over the last 400 years involves an extensive period of Spanish rule, which led to the native Hispanic population being driven from the island and replaced by African slaves. Around the mid-19th century, the British showed up and told the Spanish to get the hell out. Soon after, slavery was abolished, and the work vacated in their absence was offered by the British mainly to Chinese indentured servants and other foreigners working under similar agreements. During this time, a significant amount of British influence became apparent in Jamaican society, especially in the upper echelons of privilege and wealth, specifically in the form of taking on aristocratic traits, something to transpire because their acquisition of the island nearly coincided with the start of perhaps the most pretentious span in human history, the Victorian era. If you've been to Jamaica, you know that any random guy you approach on the street might actually have a name like Neville Chamberlain. Educated people in Jamaica often speak with a very articulate, regal air about them as well. So, if you've been born into such privilege, it naturally becomes what you expect from the world moving forward. Two-story home, housekeepers, a nanny, and private school in Jamaica is almost like private jet wealth in America. But what's important to note is that he feels entitled to this consideration of being privileged and won't relent in his unwillingness to shed that ideology moving forward in a new life as an immigrant. Most immigrants are poor. They're not coming from a good life. They're looking for one. And at the root of that desire is a necessity for a combination of three things required to succeed in that capacity: hard work, humility, perseverance. Colin Ferguson will fail to achieve these ideals in his quest to find happiness in America. So he leaves Jamaica in 1982, 4 years after his father's death in a car crash, and heads to the U.S. on a visitor's visa. After a short time in Miami, Colin decides to settle in California, but quickly learns some harsh realities about his new existence. His status as an immigrant, especially being a visitor and not a permanent resident, dictates that the jobs he's going to find will be fairly menial in nature. Consistent with that notion, he begins working at a liquor store, but soon feels a great deal of discontent because it's inconsistent with his privileged upbringing. Now, if you try to put this into perspective for a moment, it's easy to see Colin doesn't have it so badly after all. He's an immigrant who's been in the country only 2 years and doesn't have citizenship, so being a cashier and a stocker at a liquor store really isn't such a terrible thing. He had opportunity. But he hated the fact that what he really wanted was the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow and not the struggles involved in the journey it takes to arrive in that place. It had been given to him in Jamaica by his birthright, and now that same principle is causing him hardship elsewhere. The tables have turned. But he doesn't like it now because he's the one living in a shack while people right next door have nannies and housekeepers. He believes he's owed that privilege. To make matters worse, Colin, who wasn't raised in the throes of the institutionalized racism prevalent in American society, especially that which existed back in 1982, quickly becomes outraged that his status as a black man is not tantamount to what he enjoyed while under his father's roof in Jamaica. He goes from playing cricket and having a housekeeper to selling people booze for a measly paycheck. But the problem isn't that he's stuck in this spot. It's that he refuses to put in the work to change his fortunes, instead opting to start blaming everybody else. But again, this is the wrong road to travel because blaming everybody else, right or wrong, means you'll never change, you'll never get what you want, and like the engine that can no longer cool itself, you might explode. So, by the mid-1980s, Colin Ferguson is fed up with the lack of opportunity in California, and for all intents and purposes, already incensed about racism. In fact, he's so angry that he's not making any friends because most of what he has to say involves racist rhetoric. True to that, Colin ends up a loner who's overly defensive, angry, and sensitive to the extent he'll blow up at the slightest insinuation of racism or even what he might consider to be consistent with such. It's in these early years of his move to America that we see his isolation from normal societal patterns begin to form, and the basis for it is one idea. People are scared of Colin Ferguson. Whites, blacks, Asians, Hispanics, and more. He's alienating himself from society, and doing so in a very strange way that's difficult for most people to understand. He wants to use hatred as a catalyst for change. But hatred in American society is the number one element that prevents societal change. There's a reason we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr., not Colin Ferguson. He came from a life where he had to do very little to receive a lot in return, only to end up in a life where he had to give an extraordinary effort to get a little in return. He was bitter and angry in a way that didn't resonate with poor immigrants who were able to achieve better perspective due to hardship in the past. Colin Ferguson never had to overcome that level of adversity and cracked. Meanwhile, all around him, guess what immigrants in California do on a regular basis? Succeed. In school, in the job market, in small business, in relationships. And what all of those successes have in common is they aren't based in hatred. They're based in change, movement, persistence, adaptation, evolution. But Colin isn't having it. He's jealous and decides to head back east to make a life for himself in Long Island, New York. Now, he doesn't specify why he's moving the first time around, but we'll later learn, when he makes this same move in reverse, and then back again, that he didn't want to compete with Hispanics and immigrants for jobs. Basically, we have someone who's an immigrant in his own right, feeling that it's beneath him to compete with other immigrants because they come from poverty and he comes from privilege. But the truth is that they outworked him, and it made him sick. Most of these Hispanics and immigrants he speaks of come from poverty and hard work, so what they bring with them to this country is a work ethic that, when combined with newly discovered opportunity, will allow them to succeed. If he was better than they were, he wouldn't have had a problem competing. But he did, because he was entitled his whole life and struggled to adapt when that privilege was lost. What makes the situation even worse is that Colin has a me attitude that's all about his hardship and nothing else. However, if you study the nature of how immigration works, what's often revealed is that first-generation immigrants don't reap the benefits of their own hard work in the same way that their children and grandchildren might. Colin is simply not in the mindset of the immigrant, which is to create long-term strategy for familial success that allows a group of people to flourish in a supportive environment. He's a loner who offers no sense of community to those around him, instead opting to spread fear and discontent. And again, like many people I've discussed on my show previously, Colin is going to attempt to remedy this situation by making a geographical move to accommodate an emotional issue. And guess what? He's going to fail. Miserably. A move to New York means he'll be in another huge, competitive, expensive American city where pointing fingers isn't going to get him anywhere, and he's still going to have to deal with people of all races finding the success that he isn't. But this is around the time where white people become a strong target of his racial hatred in terms of expressing it explicitly and without regard for consequence. So, it's apparent that Colin is going to blame others for his fate in this world, a pattern developed from the sense of entitlement born in the privilege of his youth. Of course, the racism of which he speaks is real, and not a fabrication of his disturbed mind. The problem is that the best way to not succeed in any given career path is to make it abundantly clear that you really want to kill people. And that's what happens from the earliest days of Colin Ferguson's experience in New York, where neighbors and his landlord report knowing a quiet but very defensive man who would often speak of his hatred for white people. Meanwhile, Colin's career prospects aren't any better during this period, yet he ends up meeting a woman of Jamaican descent, Audrey Warren, and the two marry soon after. By 1987, Colin has enrolled in Nassau County Community College and seems to be building a solid foundation for the future. Unfortunately, his wife ultimately finds him too intense and aggressive for her liking, too easily agitated, and a divorce follows. At the same time, Colin is doing very poorly in school and ends up having a disciplinary hearing at the college for becoming aggressive with a professor who files a complaint after the incident. So Colin leaves school and finds work as some type of a clerk at a manufacturing company that makes security equipment, a position with which he's terribly dissatisfied, though it's still a job. That is, until one day he reaches for something on a high shelf while standing on a stool and winds up falling. He injures his head, neck, and back in the process, earning himself the meager sum of about $75 per week in compensation. Meanwhile, the company terminates him, and Colin is enraged by the insult. But in an interesting turn of events, Ferguson returns to school at Nassau County College in 1989 while supporting himself on the tiny sum from the settlement with his employer. He lives in a one-room apartment in Flatbush, basically a closet, and has no luxuries other than a radio, if you would consider that one in an age where TV dominated in every way. He had a small bed and not much else, including hope. Colin was running out of that. Or was he? Because while his hatred and desire to harm people continues to escalate, Colin Ferguson manages to make Dean's List 3 semesters in a row. Now, how could that be? The same man who did very poorly in this same school just a couple of years earlier as a part-time student now makes Dean's List as a full-time student multiple times. Many people, in their analysis of this case, find that baffling. However, I think it's actually very simple. We just need to revisit the same concept. Privilege. When Colin was in school part-time, he was also working full-time and therefore not privileged in any way. He had to be totally self-sufficient day in and day out. Conversely, when he got hurt and began receiving payments from the government, no matter how insignificant they were, somebody else was taking care of him. Once Colin was entitled again, he flourished as he had in Jamaica. But this is going to be his downfall, because he knows he needs it to continue. And the situation clearly has a shelf life. So we don't know the specifics of Colin's injuries, particularly the extent of the damage, but one would have to speculate that if he was fired in light of this, that other issues were present, or perhaps the claim wasn't entirely legitimate. Given his thought pattern leading up to the crime, combined with the tiny settlement, and the fact he was fired by the company with no regard for it being sued, I have to believe this injurious incident was falsified in some way, shape, or form, or at least suspected of being such, and probably was apparent to his employer based upon his extreme level of discontent with his lifestyle. But during this process, Colin indulges in yet another incident involving aggression toward a professor at Nassau County College, and is once again disciplined for it, but this time he's kicked out. Despite his recent academic performance, they've had enough of Colin Ferguson. Yet, based upon these solid grades, he's able to transfer to Adelphi University, where we'll clearly see more of the same from him. True to that notion, Colin begins school there and soon garners a reputation among fellow students and professors as a racist prone to spouting hateful rhetoric with little regard for the circumstances. He's also described as somebody who was ready to go off at any moment, in a prideful defense of any perceived slight by another person. Two incidents of note come to light during his time at the school, one being an accusation by Colin that a white woman yelled racial slurs at him in a campus library. However, an investigation revealed that incident never happened. I'm not suggesting that Colin exaggerated what was said. He actually fabricated the story in order to give himself a platform to vent. Beyond that, and on a more serious note, he showed up at a meeting involving a room full of students and faculty discussing a trip to South Africa. In fact, Colin interrupts multiple times, first to note that they should be taking a trip to the country to get rid of all the white people, then moving into a rant about an upcoming black revolution, and culminating in a bold statement that makes no attempt to disguise its intentions. Collins suggests they should kill all white people. Of course, colleges tend to be pretty liberal, for the most part. You can have an opinion. And this is America, where you can especially have an opinion. But genocide crosses the line. It's offensive and threatening to almost everybody. So, Colin Ferguson gets suspended and never returns to school. His apartment in Flatbush is 10 feet by 6 feet. He's been surviving off $75 per week, and he just got shown the door at yet another institution of higher learning. What he decides is that he's still injured from the fall he took a couple years ago in 1989 while doing clerical work, and would like to explore reopening that case. In doing so, he contacts a Manhattan law firm under a false name, only to give his real identity once inside. However, the attorney who agrees to meet with him is so disturbed by his demeanor that for the first time in her career, she asks a law clerk to sit in on the meeting. Of course, her suspicions are proven correct as they decide to not represent Colin Ferguson and subsequently suffer his wrath in a series of threatening phone calls. These communications are so concerning that the firm starts locking its doors and confirming Colin Ferguson isn't outside before letting anyone in. On one occasion, Colin actually calls, referencing a massacre that took place in California. Naturally, Colin will decide the series of negative interactions isn't his fault, and insinuates that the attorneys he's consulted aren't really black because they're unwilling to help him. And for me, this is where it's starting to get scary. He doesn't realize the level of aggression and hostility he's employing on a regular basis, and believes the poor reactions of its recipients is definitely no fault of his. He has systematically and intentionally removed himself from every opportunity in which he could have succeeded, from school to the workplace. He's making physical threats, suing people, getting suspended, expelled, fired, and so on. It's all his fault. Every bit of that is his fault. But he won't engage that logic. It's going to be somebody else's fault. All of it. Right up until the bitter end. But Colin has hit rock bottom at this point. He's ruined everything for himself in New York. So what does he do? You got it. He makes a geographical move to accommodate an emotional issue. Once again, he's packing up and heading across the country for California, sure that this will be the right opportunity. In April 1993, Colin moves to California and checks into a motel on the 22nd of the month. The next day is when everything changes. He goes to a local gun shop called Turner's Outdoorsman and places a deposit on a semi-automatic Ruger 9mm pistol. Now, the state had a 15-day waiting period at that time, and Colin qualified to make this purchase as he didn't have a criminal record that would prevent it. However, where the controversy comes into play is that he uses an expired driver's license from his previous stint in California in the 1980s as identification, and notes his current address as being the same as the motel. So Colin stays at the motel for several weeks to accommodate the 15-day waiting period, and then goes back to pay for the rest. At that point, Colin Ferguson becomes a legal gun owner. Only days later, however, he gets robbed by two African-American men in the absence of his gun, so he decides from there on out to carry it with him in a paper bag. This won't last, though, because by the next month, Colin decides he's had enough of California. Again. And guess what that means? Colin decides to move back to New York and move into the same apartment building under the same landlord because he doesn't want to compete with Hispanics and immigrants for jobs. And what's interesting to note is that this living situation is the only bridge he hasn't burned yet. Of course, he's still hoping to have his workers' compensation case reopened in order to receive a larger settlement, and is expecting word on that in the near future. But aside from that, he has nothing going for himself. He's banking on the settlement coming through and taking care of him for the foreseeable future. Accordingly, the wear and tear begins to show. Colin's landlord states that he immediately seemed more hostile and aggressive upon returning from California, and that the focus of his communications was relevant to killing white people, often in some type of revolution. It's at this time Colin starts taking 5 showers a day, routinely being heard by neighbors chanting phrases about black people rising up to kill whites. Eventually, his landlord asks him to move out, which is a crushing blow to Colin, but it only gets worse. That's when he learns his claim has been denied. Nobody's going to take care of him, and he's burned just about every bridge a man possibly ever could, in a desperate pursuit of success, and in the name of something that has never borne fruit for any group or individual in the history of humanity. Hatred. So Colin is in a bad place. He has a lot of anger, some issues with mental illness, and a gun with 160 rounds of ammunition. Society is going to pay for what they've done to him. None of this is his fault. Now, his workers' compensation case was scheduled to be reviewed on December 3rd, and he was confident this would result in victory. But they decide to not review his case any further, and the matter is settled. Colin gets nothing more. And that's when he begins to plot his next move. He decides to board a train around 5:30 p.m. on December 7th, heading out of Penn Station in New York City toward Long Island. As this was a train headed to what's considered more of a suburban location right outside the city limits, Colin decides it's the right move to murder as many white people as possible, with regard for exiting New York Mayor David Dinkins, an African-American man. Colin claims he wanted the event to transpire once they were outside the city to negate criticism levied at Dinkins. These are the type of delusions he's having. He believes that in some way or another, this is an honor. He truly believes that's courteous. But here we are the evening of December 7th, 1993. The train is rolling in toward the Marillion station, and it's now or never on this particular opportunity for Colin. The train is going to come to a halt at the platform and free his potential captives. All around him, people are going about their business, reading newspapers and books, listening to music, thinking about life. This was before smartphones, and even before cell phones were practical for the public. So often what you were limited to, in terms of entertainment, was staring at somebody's shoelaces or an advertisement above you and pondering your existence, whether that meant your date on Friday night, the roast you were planning to make Sunday, or even your own mortality. You'd wonder how long you'd live, and maybe how you'd die. But no matter what any of the passengers on the train that night might have been thinking, the 6 who were about to lose their lives made these considerations in the ignorance of a monster seated among them, a man pushed beyond his limits. 19 others were about to feel his wrath as well, in the form of serious gunshot wounds. 80 innocent people were set to endure 3 minutes of terror. For some of them, the lives they had pondered so greatly that evening would be no more. And for others, the concerns that had weighed so heavily on them prior to the incident would seem insignificant in the aftermath of the brutal violence. But in between, there would be chaos, revenge, and imminent bloodshed. That's when Colin Ferguson stood up and calmly drew his Ruger 9mm pistol. Of course, the reason he chose this target of a train car is not only the fact that he can keep his victims trapped within, but in 1992, Colin was arrested after an incident with a white woman on another train when he became upset that she sat next to him. When the woman refused to move, Colin jammed one elbow and a knee against her, pinning her to the seat. He had to be forcefully extracted. So the moment of truth has arrived. Colin Ferguson is going to get his revenge. Finally. As though he's a conductor collecting tickets, he slowly walks the aisle from the back of the car where he's seated, turning toward people in their seats as he passes. Only this man is firing a handgun, and it quickly becomes apparent. A panic ensues, and passengers run for the other end of the train car. Colin pulls the trigger about every half second, turning this place into a human shooting gallery. He's described as methodical and not emotional or out of control. But people are screaming. Blood is everywhere. One witness recounts being shot several times by Ferguson, only to fall and witness a young woman get shot dead as she tried to crawl across the aisle. In less than 3 minutes, Colin has unloaded two clips and is making a move to reload with a third. Three men who were taking cover nearby realize this and storm the gunman, tackling him, where he gets pinned against a seat. But not before he manages to shoot 25 people. Word reaches the front of the train that there's a gunman aboard, but a decision is made to not open the doors yet because the last two cars haven't reached the platform. One employee realizes the urgency, however, and manages to open the train car door from outside. Nearby is an off-duty cop waiting to pick up his wife as he normally would, and when he realizes what happened, he jumps into the car to handcuff the shooter. Meanwhile, as Colin had been walking down the aisle pulling the trigger, he kept repeating the words, quote, "I'm gonna get you." But as soon as he's tackled by the rushing passengers, he begs them not to shoot and says, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry. What have I done? Oh God, what have I done?" In his pockets are pieces of paper that give reasons for what he did, including mentions of things such as the white woman on the train and his experience with the law firm he believes discriminated against him. Yet, among all the reasons listed for this bloodbath, not one of them is himself. Colin Ferguson, the trigger man, who altered the lives of countless families that day, feels he bears no responsibility for the crime. It's payback for what society did to him. But here he is, after the shooting, held down, trapped, and begging not to be shot, just like his victims did before him. Yet they received no mercy. He did. He's still alive today. So I think this incident says more about humanity than it does about Colin Ferguson. It says more about forgiveness than condemnation, and speaks more to survival than it does to death, which can only mean one thing is true. We are more prone to love than we are to hate. It truly does conquer all. Even Colin Ferguson. But the incident wasn't over yet. It still had to go to trial. And that's when the circus began. With the case being broadcast on Court TV and offering a very high profile due to the nature of the crime, Colin is offered pro bono representation. However, he fires his first lawyer due to philosophical differences regarding his defense and moves on to accept representation from another firm that decides on a very specific but experimental and innovative approach to the defense. They intended to claim that Collins suffered from something called black rage at the time of the crime, wherein he would be considered innocent by reason of insanity due to being overwhelmed by the rage of white privilege and all of its associated racism. Of course, it sounds a bit over the top, but if you consider the alternatives for a man who is definitively caught in the act by dozens of witnesses, the options are quite limited. But Colin refuses to go this route, and ultimately convinces the judge that he wants to fire his new counsel as well, in favor of representing himself. This is obviously a very bad idea, as self-representation in court is essentially a predetermined disaster. If you're Colin Ferguson, with no legal training, the decision is truly baffling. But he convinces the judge and decides to move forward claiming that he did bring the gun on the train, but fell asleep, at which point a white man took it from his bag and began unloading bullets into the passengers. Now, most people believe Colin was simply out of his mind, and this decision was made with the intention of truly winning in court. But that's not the case at all. What the other attorneys would not offer Colin is a defense scenario in which he could claim innocence to an extent that the perpetrator was somebody else. They wanted to make claims of insanity, but if Colin concedes insanity, then the incident is his fault, and he was wrong, despite limiting his liability in the matter. But the pattern that led to his psychosis is one in which he can never be at fault. Somebody else must be to blame in this incident. Colin could do no wrong. So if everything that went wrong in his life had been the fault of the white man, then that is exactly what he would fabricate in his mind to accommodate the existence of another guilty party who is not Colin Ferguson. Unfortunately for everybody involved in the case, this means that Colin is essentially going to create a total farce from start to finish at the trial, one that comes with the perfect result. Yet for some reason, this reality was lost on the participants, and what they believed they were watching was a man detached from reality. Yet, Ferguson knew exactly what he was doing, and got what he wanted. In the end, he maintained society was wrong, and it was all somebody else's fault. In his mind, that lone symbolic white man pulled the trigger, and he went to jail, where he'd be punished for a crime he didn't commit. They were out to get him. During the proceedings, he regularly referred to himself in the third person, as though he was truly somebody else. While cross-examining witnesses whom he had actually shot at point-blank range on the train, he would ask if they saw Colin Ferguson shooting them. Most of these people replied, "I saw you shoot me." But Colin would have none of it. He wouldn't acknowledge the inherent implications. Of course, Colin doesn't try to bait the witnesses or even outsmart them. He generally sticks to asking them to repeat prior testimony for confirmation of what they said. But in the end, the truth comes to light. Colin Ferguson is sentenced to more than 300 years in prison and will never see the light of day again, no matter how long he lives. If you're curious if he ever came to terms with the atrocity he committed, this is probably the best anecdote I can offer. Colin was imprisoned with serial killer Joel Rifkin during the 1990s, shortly after Ferguson's conviction. If you're not familiar with Rifkin, let's just say that he dismembered his first victim and left her head inside a paint can on a golf course in New Jersey. He's believed to have killed as many as 17 women altogether. Anyhow, he and Colin get into it over the use of a nearby phone, and the interaction instantly becomes hostile, with Ferguson claiming he killed 6 devils and Rifkin boasting a higher kill count as his retort. These two actually attended Nassau County College together in the past and were seemingly not strangers. Of course, the incident comes to blows, and Colin lays a beating on Joel Rifkin. Around the same time, Colin is jumped by a group of men in prison and beaten badly, walking away from the incident bloodied and with a broken nose. Yet, the prison antics don't stop there. On September 11, 2011, an Attica prison guard reported hearing Ferguson encouraging other inmates to riot, to the extent that he suggested they should kill the prison guards. So if you're wondering if Colin has learned anything, felt remorse, or been humbled, I think the best way to answer that curiosity is in the words of State Supreme Court Justice George Peck, who prosecuted Ferguson's case in court as an assistant district attorney. He said, quote, "It appears that the behavior of Colin Ferguson hasn't changed in over 20 years. And with that, I realize why he was never able to escape that claustrophobic little 10x6 room, but chose instead to retain it forever, only in the form of a prison cell, rather than a tiny apartment. It's because there's only room for one person in his world. Colin Ferguson was alone. In the absence of hatred, there would only be silence. So to this day, behind bars, Colin remains an advocate for violence and hate. But his victims have been silenced forever. Along with the 19 wounded on December 7th, 1993, the following people lost their lives. Mee Kyung Kim, a 27-year-old from New Hyde Park. Dennis McCarthy, a 52-year-old office manager. His son Kevin was also in the train car and was badly wounded in the incident. Maria Teresa Tumangan Magtoto, a 30-year-old lawyer. Amy Federici, a 27-year-old corporate interior designer. Richard Nettleton, a 24-year-old college student. And James Goricki, a 51-year-old accountant. And so, at the end of this tale, the one thing that resonates with me, more than anything else, is the notion that Colin Ferguson wanted others to feel trapped. Like he was. Like he had been every day since his parents died. And always will be. A boy in a man's body. Because he could never let go. He could never move on. He could never change. And I remember being at a point in my life where I was feeling very much the same. I was out of work, living in the smallest room of a 4-bedroom apartment, which was so small it was intended as a nursery, and just barely scraping by. In fact, not even getting by. Drowning. But slowly, every day, screaming inside, like Colin Ferguson. I remember blaming other people, maybe even everybody who crossed my path, and nothing ever changed. So I got depressed and waited for things to change. One night they finally did. There was a knock at our apartment door at 1 a.m. I had just fallen asleep and didn't even hear it, but a minute later I noticed loud voices coming from the living room. Now, I was situated all the way at the end of a hallway leading to the back of the apartment, so I had no idea what anybody was saying. The noise caught my attention, though. We had a lot of visitors in that place with 4 young roommates, but it wasn't a weekend night. And this didn't sound friendly. So I got up, went to my bedroom door, and pulled it open without hesitation. Before I saw anything behind it, my heart sank all the way to my feet. I knew. I just knew. I was trapped. I was going to die. I remember feeling the shock of knowing it was true before seeing my fate. But there he was, a young guy, probably early 20s. Maybe 5 feet 6 inches or 5 feet 7 inches at most. And he had a gun pointed directly at my face, only inches away. I don't know much about guns, but I think it was a Glock 9mm or similar. Something not much different from the weapon Colin Ferguson used. He told me to get down on the ground, and that's when I heard other voices directing my roommates in the same way. Somebody cried out in pain. And then again. Except this time it was a different person. A roommate whose bedroom was next to mine. I heard some type of disagreement, and then my roommate said he was bleeding. I knew the other men were armed, and I had to comply. So, this guy tore apart my bedsheets and hogtied me right there on the floor. He knelt down next to me afterward, pressed the gun's barrel to the back of my head, and said, "I'm gonna blow your brains out, white boy." And then he paused. Finally, he asked me where my money was. I told him I only had $7 nearby. He said if I lied one more time, he was going to shoot me. But I knew what I had to do. I had to tell the truth. I really didn't have any money. So I repeated what he believed was a lie. And there was nothing but silence to follow. A minute later, he went to my bed, grabbed the comforter, and threw it on top of me so I was completely covered. And then there was silence again. It seemed like forever. Eventually, he walked out of the room and began talking with the other guys. Soon after, I heard the front door of the apartment shut. They were gone. I lived. That's all I could think. But the gun barrel had been pressed so hard against the back of my head, it felt like it was still there. In a sense, it always will be. But as I laid there in the darkness beneath the blanket, ignorant of everything going on around me, I decided it was best to lie still. I wasn't sure they actually left. And that's when I heard footsteps. My roommate suddenly called out my name. And before I could answer, I think he saw me lying still under the blanket, because I heard him whisper, "Oh my God. No, no." And then I saw the light. The blanket lifted, and what was revealed was my roommate's bloody face. He was covered in it. He'd been pistol whipped for offering his opinion when not asked for it. But he was smiling because I was alive. We all were. And he reached down to help me up, grabbing my arm. I stood and looked back at him. I remember our eyes meeting and recognizing the terror of the event. It could have ended much differently. A few days later, over drinks on the weekend, we pondered what might have been. And at the conclusion of that discussion, I remember my roommate going to bed while I remained sitting there. Son of a bitch, I thought. We made it out of this thing. We're still here. But how much longer would we live, I wondered. A day? A year? Maybe 100? Almost a decade later, The answer came for him. I'm still waiting for mine. But in the meantime, one thing will always be true. That gun pressed against my head means that I should always keep moving forward and never look back. Somehow, when I needed it most, that lesson was there for me. During the worst of times, it's helped me to push on. Because I was trapped in that room, in life, and worst of all, in my head. Long before the gunman arrived. But I made it out. All of that is behind me now. This train is moving again and has no plans to stop.